is it?
Well, we are in Mark chapter 8. We're going to cover verses 1 to 30 today. And in all honesty, if we were really moving at the pace that maybe I would most desire, this would be like three separate sermons. But I think it has a place together, and it's going to keep us moving at the pace that we have on our schedule. So we are going to cover 1 to 30 today. That is to say that there's a lot in here. And if there is a piece of this that is an application that you love that I just pass over, or a question that you have that I don't answer, I apologize, and know that I'm yelling at me too. And if you have a question, feel free to come ask. But yeah, so today we're going to look at this, and we're going to try to see this one big message that we might be able to see here in verses 1 through 30. We're kind of in the middle, like we said last week. We've begun this training camp, if you will, for the apostles that were out wandering, and Jesus is with them. And kind of up to the point where they left, the apostles and some of his other people were along for the ride, but a lot of what he was doing was for the people of Galilee. It was for them too, but it was also for the other people. Now, that's almost flip-flops the priority. Other people are benefiting from the lessons that Jesus is teaching to the apostles, but the heart and the focus of what we're doing around here at this moment is, in essence, to do things to teach the apostles. And we kind of began that last week looking at those stories, and so today's really no different. And in this today, I think I'm going to point out some symmetry to us, some paralleling that Mark does that helps us see this story and helps us kind of understand some of these bigger points that he's got for the apostles in this. Maybe also just be interesting for us. And then at the end of all of it, of course, we'll try to pull out and try to understand some ways that it can apply for us, what we're reading today, that we're not just studying a story and seeing what's happening and learning, but also taking something for our life. So with all that in mind, let me read verses 1 through 26, because we're going to hold on to 27 to 30 till the end here. So I'm going to read verses 1 through 26 right now, and then we'll come back to the top. So starting in Mark 8, verse 1. In those days, when a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from very far away." And his disciples answered him, "How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?" And he asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd, and they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away, and immediately he got in the boat with his disciples, and he went to the district of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them and got in the boat again and went to the other side. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only 1 loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware the leaven of the Pharisee and the leaven of Herod." And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of the broken pieces did you take up?" They said to him, 12. "And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full did you take up?" And they said, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" And they came to Bethsaida, and some of the people brought him to a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again. He opened his eyes and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." All right, let's hold there and let's come back up to the top. Let's look through what we've got. And then as we come back down to where we just finished, we'll pick back up with verse 27. So coming back to the beginning, to the feeding of the 4,000, I want us to just kind of quickly look through some things that are in here that I think are important for us to see. But then I also want us to note, too, that one of the big arguments against this is that people want to say, oh, well, this is just repeating something that happened. This didn't actually happen twice. And I want to give you some evidence to say, well, that's just very untrue. So let's go back up here to the top. It says, in those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and he said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from very far away. So there's just two things in these verses that I read I want us to notice. The first is the very couple of first words, in those days. So if we remember where we just were last, we were in the Decapolis. So we were in that Gentile region over around the Sea of Galilee on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. And so in those days, so while we're still in the Decapolis where we had this crowd that was around him and he was healing, he's got this crowd gathered and they've been there for days, it says. And then here's this one other thing I want to point out. Jesus says, I have compassion on the crowd. Now, we know Jesus is a compassionate man. There's plenty of examples where we can go to and see him doing acts that we would describe as compassionate. But quite rarely does he actually himself say, I have compassion. And here he does. So us seeing Jesus' compassion and attributing that as a character of his nature is not just something we're doing by looking at him healing someone and saying, oh, how compassionate, how merciful. Here he says, I have compassion. And so for us, see and know that this is a character and a nature of Jesus, that he is compassionate. He cares. Compassion doesn't always mean that we sit there and we see somebody who's hurting and we say, none of it's your fault. You're a perfect, beautiful little angel. You just keep doing what you're doing. That's not compassion. But Jesus was compassionate. He saw someone in their status, saw where they were, saw how broken they were, cared for them, and did something to change it. You don't have compassion on a perfect whose life is perfect. You have compassion on someone whose life isn't perfect, on someone who needs change, who needs something to affect in a positive way. So when he sees them, he has compassion. And he's ready to make something happen about it, to bring about change. He says, well, his disciples rather say in verse 4, and his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? So let's ask ourselves, did the disciples forget this kind of monumental moment that happened just a couple months ago? And are they asking, how exactly can one do this? Or potentially, should we consider what this is about for them and who Jesus is with? The last time we were in Jewish lands and the disciples were the ones who were worried about how they're going to eat, you should send them home. They need to eat. But now we're in Gentile lands. And Jesus is the one who is looking at them and saying, I have compassion. Or is it perhaps that the disciples aren't sitting there saying, how are you possibly going to do this? But rather they're saying, what exactly are you about to do? Are you really about to do what I think you're about to do? Are they really about to receive that same kind of blessing? Remember where we just were last week about the Syrophoenician woman and her being accepting of being the dog. And that wasn't just for her, but also for the apostles to see. And now here again, we're about to have this moment where that same blessing that went to all these people, that he creates for them, this food, something that happened for the Jewish people back in their Exodus, Not for anybody else yet. You're going to bring about food out of your own hands, out of your own creation for them? How are you about to do that exactly? Oh, the same way you did it for us. This is not the disciples just confused. Perhaps we could read into it that fairly that Jesus doesn't solve every problem they have simply by a miracle. They do go out and buy food and eat. They do just cross the sea by taking a boat, not by holding hands and walking like Jesus proved he could do. So we could fairly read that part of it is that just Jesus doesn't solve everything by a miracle. But also we need to understand what's happening, that he is here not just with the Jewish people, but with the Gentile people. And he is trying to get these apostles to come along and see the idea that he himself is bringing them into the fold. Because if we're looking back in Acts, especially in the early part of Acts, these same guys who saw all of this same stuff, who received the same teaching, they still struggle with the idea that the Gentiles are going to come in the full way. So it certainly is imperative that Jesus makes sure that he paints the foundation of this picture, that they're going to receive the same blessing. So in verse 4 it says, "And his disciples answered him, 'How can one feed these people here in this desolate place?' And he asked them, 'How many loaves do you have?' And they said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them. And he gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away." So again, when we look at this, before we go and look at some of the differences between the two stories, one, I hope we see how similar they are. And two, I want us to notice this too. In the first time, it was 12. This idea of perfect governance and reign and completion. And now it's 7. This idea of completion and rest. Those numbers aren't for nothing. We should notice that. It doesn't mean that Mark is just making them up so to the Jewish person it sounds better. Remember, he's not even writing to the Jewish person. He's writing to the people in Rome. Jesus, who's sovereign over all things, knows what he's doing and is trying to make points. Because we've already read ahead. Remember, he's going to point out on the boat here in just a little bit to the apostles. How many baskets were there, fellas? 7. How many baskets were there, fellas? 12. Do you not understand? That idea of perfect completion, of sovereign power, Jesus is making that point. So now let's look at this, though, because like I said, people want to poke at this and say, well, hold on, though. Is this actually just the same event? I mean, they are pretty similar. But let me give you a couple reasons why they're not. Well, the first is that here in verse 2, we read that it was after 3 days where Jesus was ready to feed them. But back in our first account, it was like that same day that they were ready to eat. And then the next thing is that in verse 5, he doesn't organize them into specific groups. He just has them sit down. And then we saw that it was 7, not 12 baskets that they had. There's a different number of bread and fish. There's 4,000, not 5,000. Here's one that we don't necessarily see in the English, but when we read it in Greek, we use different terms for the baskets. Here in this one, we use a word spirus. This is the same kind of basket that was big enough for Paul to get lowered down in Damascus when he's escaping in Acts. So big old basket, big old laundry hamper. Then in the other one, in our first version, we got the word kophanos. And that's just like a little lunch pail. Think about, you know, the little lunchbox you brought to school. Can Paul get lowered down in that? Nope. So we've got two totally separate things that we've got all of our food being collected in. So all of that, if that's not enough for you, then we can remember what we read just a little bit later on here in Mark 8, where Jesus himself points out how many were there for the 4 and how many were there for the 5. Jesus himself indicates that there's 2 in this very chapter. There's no sensible reason, even just from the text itself, to say that there was one event being told twice. This is certainly happening twice. And again, the whole point of this is to say, what's the big point of this? What do we want to understand about this happening again? The Gentiles are in on this too. That's what we've been going on in this journey recently, is the Gentiles are in on this too, fellas. They're going to be a part of this too. Everyone can be my sheep. In verse 10, it says, "And immediately they got in the boat with his disciples and went on to the district of Dalmanutha." Just one real note we're not going to labor here, but if we read in Matthew, he gives us the city of Magadan or Magdala, which we know Mary of Magdalene is from. They're like right by each other. Both Mark and Matthew say in the region of, and just to use our geography like I like to do to help us understand the point, Red Canyon, is it in the region of Panguitch? Yes, it is. Red Canyon, is it in the region of Hatch? Yes, it is. Would you be correct if you went to Red Canyon to say, "I was in the region of Panguitch"? Yes, you would. Would you be correct to say you were in the region of Hatch? Yes, you would. Mark and Matthew aren't conflicting with each other. They're just two guys describing the area using a different reference point right next to each other. So it's the same region. We don't have to be confused by that. So the Pharisees now. We've reached the other side over to Dalmanutha. It's up in the north. We went from the east. We're now up in the north. We're close to Bethsaida, where we've kind of been before. We're journeying in our journey, if we can imagine. We're on the eastern side, and now we're heading up the Jordan River Valley. So we're just heading further up north. The Jordan River is the direction we're heading. So the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. Now, what's important is to understand what exactly they're asking as far as a sign goes. It says they wanted a sign from heaven to test him. Their belief, the Jewish belief, was that if you were a demon-possessed man, like back in Mark 3, they've already claimed that he was, then you could do miraculous, powerful things on earth. But miraculous things in the skies and the heavens, that's beyond you. So if you were a demon-possessed man, maybe you could heal a person. But you couldn't make an eclipse happen. You couldn't turn the sun dark in the middle of the day. They're not asking him, "Jesus, show us your power." They're just testing him. More than that, they're trying to move him around like he's their dog and that they have control over him. Has he not done enough? Because here's the thing, sorry Pharisees, but one of your own has already spilled the beans on this point that you do know who he comes from. Over in John chapter 3, at the very beginning of John 3 in verses 2 and 3, well really let's just say 1 through 3, Jesus is meeting with a Pharisee, Nicodemus. And this is what Nicodemus says to Jesus, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God. No one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." Again, that's Nicodemus, a Pharisee. So he sells his brothers out. These guys know. These Pharisees who have been around in the area that Jesus has been doing most of his ministry in, they have seen more than enough. They don't need a sign. They want control because they know they're losing it. This isn't what they're looking for. Isn't, if Jesus, we've been hearing all these stories and we can't fathom how could someone possibly could do that. Could you please show us? Could you please show us the way that you care? That's not what's happening. This is dance one more time for us, monkey. Show us that we're in charge. Show us that you really come from what we want. Here's how he replies. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them, got in the boat again, and went to the other side. He sighs deeply in his spirit. The phrase that's used here, Anastasio, only time it's used in the whole of the Greek Bible. This is a unique expression from Jesus. This deep, from like the, like we would say, like, he just said that from the pit of his soul. Like, this is deep from within him. Just this deep sigh. Why? My own shepherds of my own people, the ones who should know better than anyone. Why is it always you who's coming to me like this? Why do you always seek a sign when you've already had them? No signs are going to be given this generation. He's already been veiling his teaching under parables. And now, like we'll see here just in a second, when he does miracles, he leads people away from the crowds. You had your chance, Galilee. You've seen your signs. We've already read how he told Galilee that if these other pagan cities had seen all that you had seen, surely they would have repented by now. You don't need another sign. He goes on his way. And he brings his disciples with him. And when they're in the boat, here's what he says. It says, "Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they only had one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, 'Watch out, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod.' And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you yet not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many full baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?'" He's in the boat with them. And he gives them the warning. They notice, they aren't even discussing yet anything. It just says they were in the boat and they hadn't brought bread. And then he cautions them and says, "Beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Leaven, the product of yeast. Well, yeast in Jewish literature and the Old Testament, and just in their own like rabbinic writings, from the ancient times to today, yeast is associated with the idea of sin. So what is the product of sin? Leaven. The leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Beware the systems of this religious world. Beware the systems of the government in this world. And they decide to start arguing about who forgot the bread. Classic teenage boys. What are you going to do? And Jesus, being ignored with this statement and them arguing over who was the forgetful one, asked them, "Do you not have a heart that I've replaced? Have I not given you eyes to see and ears to hear? What about those loaves for the 5,000? How many were there, fellas? 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many were there, fellas? 7. Do you not understand? Do you not see that the product of the bread of these people leads to one thing? Yet the bread that I have, it's complete. It's full. Perfect. Bringing absolute rest. Do you not yet understand?" It's interesting. He asked them if they can see. And now we have this story. And they came to Bethsaida. So again, just continuing on up this Jordan River, up in right above the Sea of Galilee to the north. "And some brought him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, 'Do you see anything?' And he looked up and said, 'I see people, but they look like trees walking.' Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes, and his sight was restored. And he saw everything clearly." We've already kind of seen Jesus do something like this just last week. This personal interaction. We've seen enough. We know that Jesus doesn't have to mix up a mud for him to see. He does it so this man who was led to him by others might see and know and be involved in this. And when he takes the mud away for the first time and he looks, there's partial sight. And then he brings about full sight. And he charges him not to enter the village, just like he did with the man whose tongue he restored. With the man whose ears he brought back. So why? What is the point of Mark putting this story here for us? What is the point of Jesus doing this, of taking him out away from the crowds, of healing this man? I mean, for one, for the sake of this man. But what more? Well, I think our next story is going to really perfectly parallel this. This man had partial sight. Jesus gave him partial sight. And Jesus who all across the course of Mark up to this point has been looking for faith, to be motivated by the faith of the other man. He gives him partial sight. And then he brings about full sight. He sees everything clearly, crisp, from afar and near. Complete vision. Let's read 27 to 30. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist. And others say Elijah. And others say one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. For the first time, a man has declared Jesus is Christ. God did at his baptism. The demons have when they run in fear from him. But now man has declared with his own lips for the first time in Mark who Jesus is. This is the first half climax of the book of Mark. Mark has been trying to tell us, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? And he finally gets the answer from his apostles. Our story is going to turn from who is Jesus into what he's going to be doing. Here it is. Who am I? You are the Christ. He asked him first, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist. The greatest of all the prophets up to Jesus." That'd be pretty great, wouldn't it? Others say Elijah. Wow, what respect to be a man who never even died, just was taken to heaven and then came back. That'd be something. Others say one of the prophets. Now we've really stepped down. There's been hundreds, if not thousands, of prophets over the course of the history of the nation of Israel. If you're just one of those, I mean, that's still better than to be one of the thousands of the prophets, but I mean, that's not a lot. Partial sight. There's something about you. We recognize that. You can't possibly be just one of us rank and file dudes. But who do you say that I am? And now we have full vision. You are the Christ. What a moment. What a moment for Peter to answer, not just for himself, but to speak for all. Who do you, the apostle, say that I am? You are the Christ. Certainly before this, like we pointed out, they likely were starting to believe this. They left their families, they left their jobs, they've walked away from many of the beloved customs of Judaism to follow after Jesus. We had the moment on the boat, and when everyone else left, they didn't. Clearly, something was in their mind before this very second, but in this moment, they're ready to stand on it and declare it. How wonderful. Let's look back at the whole of this. And one, I want to show you a neat parallel, because I think it's part of the point that we have to see here. Like we've been talking about, all of where we've been for the last 2 weeks has been in kind of this training for the apostles. And so much of the point is not only just what they're learning as far as the truth of Jesus, but also these lessons about bringing in the Gentiles. And so I think Mark intentionally parallels these stories. We can see where we've been for a little bit before the last couple weeks, all in just today. Consider this. In Mark 6, 31 through 44, we have the first feeding of the multitude. And then today, we have the second. And when he finishes feeding the multitude, back earlier in Mark 6, they have the crossing of the sea that night. And what happens after the feeding of the multitude here? He crosses the sea with his disciples in the boat. And when they finish crossing the sea, they had a conflict with the Pharisees. And now, here too, we have conflict with the Pharisees. And following conflict with the Pharisees, Jesus discusses bread. And here too, he discusses bread in the boat with his apostles. And following the conversation around bread, he has a pretty interactive healing. And when he ends that interactive healing, we get a confession of faith. I think, again, the point here that we should see is this is for everyone. The Jewish people had specific promises to them, and I'm not downplaying how important that is. But they didn't earn the right to have Jesus come and be their Messiah. God's promise to them in the first place was a mercy to begin with. It wasn't an earned promise. Abraham didn't do something to earn that promise. God gave it to him so he might display his character. So for us, same thing. We're in this. Hallelujah, praise the Lord. We didn't do anything to be in this. And when we first hear that, our thoughts might go to, well, all right, yeah, I guess. I mean, praise God that I have received it. But yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't do anything to deserve it. And maybe we're a little sad. Personally, I want to find hope in that. I didn't do anything to deserve this. I did the opposite of doing things to deserve this, and yet I received it. And if that's the case, that means there's no one, not a single person, who's done anything to deserve this. Which means no one ever can do anything to deserve this. Which means not one person is so far removed from mercy that they can't be brought in. If none of us are good enough to have mercy, and yet people do, then that means everyone who isn't good enough to have mercy is able to have mercy. It means all of us are able to come and be a part of this. That all of us can come to grace. I think the question is, do we see? Do we see and understand? I mean, if we're outside of being a believer, then do we see and understand he is who he says he is, that he is this Savior, the one who has come for the Jew and the Gentile, and that we might all come under that mercy? If we're a believer, and that's where I want to settle on more now for us, I still think there's things that we need to see and know and apply to our heart when we see and declare that he is the Christ. And just using our lessons from today as we're looking through the text, I think we can go through and pick out some things for us. We want to become more Christ-like. So are we compassionate with all people? Do we see and understand who he is in his compassion and play that out? Do we see and know that, look, I have so much pity for the man still chained in his sin? Not because he's a perfect man who deserves to be free, but because I was him and I didn't deserve to be free, and I am by Jesus, and so I want him to have the same freedom that I have. Something needs a change in his life, and I have compassion because I know that I might be able to be an avenue through which that change can come, because I can bring the message of the gospel to him and his life can be changed by Christ. Do I see and understand that he is compassionate? Do I see and understand that I've had signs in my life? I don't need to go asking for more. He's not my puppet. He's my Savior. He's my Lord, my Father, my friend. But he's not my little Jesus in a pocket that I get to pull out and deploy to do whatever my will and my wish is whenever I need it. I trust him for who he is because he's already shown it. He didn't have to do one thing in my life, and he's done enough to show he is who he says he is. And if he is who he says he is, that alone is enough for me to know that's the one I want to serve. The Almighty, the All-Powerful, the All-Loving. That's the one I'm going to hook my wagon to. Even better that he chooses to personally intervene in my life and personally live a life with me. And I don't just have to be some mindless slave who's following along and saying, well, this seems to be the best way. Serve the most powerful one. That's better, I guess. But rather, I get to walk with my friend. That's great. but I walk with him and I follow him, not lead him on a leash. Don't let us be the one who's sitting there and testing. Are we watching out for the Pharisees and for the Herods of our world? Do we see and understand that the fruit and the product of the systems of the world leads to death? And that only Jesus leads to this complete, perfect, full, sovereign life? What is the bread that we're eating? Is it the bread of the world or is it the bread of Christ? Do we come to him and trust that it is sweet with him? Trust that it is peaceful with him? Trust that we are at comfort with him? Trust that the troubles of this world are a privilege and a reward for a life leading closer with him? Do we see and understand that? And lastly, do we just fully see and understand who he is? And not just see and understand it, but declare it. Do we see and know the truth of who he is and not let it sit on our lips? He's given us eyes to see. He's given us ears to hear. He's removed our heart of stone and put in a heart of flesh. Now let us become and use our mouth as a trumpet to speak his truth. It's him who came to do this. In our passage, in our bulletin today, Isaiah 35, it says, "Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. The lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert." God himself showed up. He cleared out the ears of the deaf. He relieved the tongue of the mute. He opened the eyes of the blind. We're watching Jesus do this in his life right now in Mark. So what do? As it said there in Ezekiel, we have tongues that speak of joy. Or as it said in Isaiah, or as this says in Ezekiel, that we can declare it and have hope. God has come in the flesh, been with us, compassionate and personal, giving us a system that leads to life, not to death. That he is the river, the living water, which restores our soul and gives us what we need to walk each day. That this is what he has said from time has began, that we can look back even to the Old Testament, even to Ezekiel, to read things like this, where it says in Ezekiel 37, starting in verse 26, where it says, "I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will set them in their land and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore. My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." That day will fully come with Jesus. We'll come for eternity with him when he has made all things good, and we all live together for eternity. But even now, in this moment in Mark, he came. He dwelt with his people. This anointed Messiah to come. That is the Christ. Christ is the Greek for Messiah. Messiah is the Hebrew word they come up with for this anointed one that was promised from God. This king who would come, who would rule and reign. He's come. He rules and reigns over our hearts. We have the opportunity to allow him to do that. The question is, do you see it? Let's pray.